This is Ozarks at Large. Imagine trying to tell the story of Arkansas in just under 500 pages. Four authors do just that in the just-published second edition of Arkansas, A Narrative History, published by the University of Arkansas Press. Jeannie Wayne, Thomas DeBlack, George Sabo, and Morris Arnold examine almost everything that has formed the people and the history of the state. This month, two of the authors, Jeannie Wayne and George Sabo, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to discuss the book with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums. She is a professor of history at the University of Arkansas, and he is the director of the Arkansas Archaeological Survey and professor of anthropology at the U of A. Kyle asked them how they managed to go from Pangaea on page 3 to Mike Beebe on page 463 and get everything important in between.
Well, when you pick yourself up off the floor from contemplating the process of writing a book like this, you begin to compartmentalize. And most of us have been, we lecture. We already have had to make the decision about what goes in and what doesn't go into a lecture covering a chronological period of time. So we are accustomed, at least to some extent, to doing that. Now, having said that, we're also accustomed to assigning our students readings from all the stuff that we're not going to cover in class. So it is daunting. And I think all historians, and I guess anthropologists too, make decisions based on what they, A, think really absolutely has to be in there, and two, or B, what they're most interested in, you know, what they privilege as it most important. We all have point of view. Economic historians are going to privilege the economic. Political historians are going to privilege the political, et cetera. So that's one thing. George?
Well, I think also because it is a narrative, a story, on top of compartmentalizing or picking the events that we want to emphasize, we're attentive to drawing the links between the events that gives us the large story, that gives us the narrative in the round that goes from Pangaea to fracking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. One of the joys of working in a collaboration with George and Buzz Arnold and Thomas DeBlack is that we were all congenial to work with and respectful of each other's points of view, even when at times we didn't fully agree over certain interpretations.
And I should point out that while it is a narrative history, it's still history in that when whoever wrote a chapter wasn't sure of what happened, take Archibald Yell's death.
Right.
Did he charge into enemy lines or did his horse panic and take him there by accident? You let the reader know that history is not sure.
Oh, yes. Yes. I think that sometimes students find that unsettling. They just want to know what the right answer is. But I think history, students also become engaged when they understand that it's not fixed, that they can make an argument. They can go find evidence. And I guess anthropologists and archaeologists would be the same.
Well, even more so. And I think some of these mysteries add to the allure, add to the interest that people have. And so rather than trying to mask them, I think bringing them out into the open is what does attract a lot of interest to the subject matter.
Well, yeah, I find it fascinating that we don't know and probably never will know just who the first Europeans in what would become Arkansas met with, which native people they met with, because they're
That's
called
true.
Different things by different people over a couple of centuries. So we don't know.
No, we don't. And we've been working on that problem for a century, and my guess is that we'll work on it for another century.
And still not know.
Well, I hope we'll eventually get a handle on that, but it's open-ended at this point.
I would imagine one of the biggest fears putting together something that is called a narrative history is, what are we leaving out?
Yes, I just had Patrick Williams, my colleague in the history department. In this edition, I trimmed several sections of the book out, and it turns out I trimmed one of his favorite stories out, and that is when George Hunter on the Dunbar Hunter expedition nearly shot his own hand off. And Patrick was just astonished that I would leave that out. And I said, well, Patrick, that's something you can now use in your lecture. you can take ownership of that.
Well, is that a challenge? I mean, mm-hmm. an anecdotal great story versus mm-hmm. we've got to get facts in. And when you update an edition, there's more that's happened.
It's true. I did have we had readers make suggestions on the second edition, and they suggested that I cut that. They didn't say how I should cut the Dunbar Hunter, but they suggested I cut it and that I add something on the Adams-Onis Treaty. And so I guess that George Hunter shooting his hand off lost out to the Adams-Onis Treaty. Thank you very much. in case you wanted to know.
Some of the suggestions from our readers are small, but then others are larger. Mm-hmm. One of the suggestions was that we add a new chapter, one that didn't exist before, on the natural environment, on the backdrop against which all of this history develops. It's true, as we all know, that tremendous changes have been brought to the environment from the time of the very earliest settlers. Swamps have been drained, fields have been cleared for agriculture, forests have been planted, cities and towns have been built, infrastructures have been developed, but there's a common substrate that underlies all of the different groups of people, the different cultures, the different civilizations that made their home in Arkansas. And it's fascinating to delve into the question of how these different groups perceived that environment and what different perceptions were accorded to the same environmental substrates. The Indians would interact with the environment as if it had a profound spiritual quality. Their economy was as religious as it was technical. And the same is true for some of the early European settlers. But later people saw the environment as a resource, something to be put to use in support of human endeavors. So we have these very, very different outlooks, these different perspectives on the environment, and adding that chapter gives us an opportunity to raise those questions and put forth some of that information.
It's all about, not all, but a lot of it is about perception, right?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
History
so.
Belongs
absolutely.
To those of us that perceive it a certain way.
Right, and those of us who write it, actually.
Yeah. Well, yes.
If you want to be in control of the minutes being taken at a meeting, take the minutes. If you want to be in control of the story, write the story.
Right, for better or ill, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I want to read a paragraph from page 142. This is from the chapter, The Rights and Rank to Which We Are Entitled. Uh-huh. The effort to establish a viable school system was further hampered by what one state official described as the indifference that pervades the public mind on the subject of education. As a result, no viable system of public education was established, and no public university was founded in the state before the Civil War. I bet you hate when lay people draw these links back, but say, wow, because we rank so low in so many educational
indices
mm-hmm. and have for so long. Mm-hmm. Is it fair to point back to something that long ago?
Absolutely. And I think Arkansas is not very different from, in fact, not different at all from some of our southern neighbors, Mississippi, even Tennessee to some extent, Alabama, Georgia. Obviously, North Carolina and Virginia did a lot better job of their public education, particularly their higher education. But southern states generally, given a certain southern ethos and perspective on state involvement and funding of anything, anything public, whether it's public education or public transportation, southern states before the Civil War and even for some time after the Civil War, loathed to spend money on such public expenditures. Before the war, it was philosophical and economic, and after the war, it was continued to be philosophical and economic in another sense, in that we were so devastated by the Civil War, it took a while for us to pick ourselves back up off the ground and get going again. But we resisted it, and when we embraced the progressive era in the early 19th century, we went about as far as we could go, and even maybe a little further than we could afford to go. But our tax basis was so low. Our wealth basis was so low. I mean, it was very difficult to us fund even the most basic human services.
Which, for you, is is more comfortable dealing with something that might have happened 200 years ago when you're very limited in what written actual history you have, or something that's much more recent where you have a lot more information, but you still don't have the hindsight yet to know how it's affected fully a generation after it.
Yeah, they both have their problems, the lack of detail. Sometimes you'd like to transport yourself back 200 years with proper vaccinations for whatever diseases you might encounter, but and interview some people just to find out what the heck really did happen. But doing more recent history, I find is it's not only problematic; it's sometimes terrifying. I mean, you people are still alive, you know, that might be that might have a stake in the story you're telling.
Little Rock Central.
I interviewed Governor Beebe, I guess, two times on two issues, and found him to be an excellent interviewer. It was on the issue of school funding and the Little Rock desegregation suits. I had read a good deal about them, articles, books, newspaper articles, a couple of fine dissertations, and still had questions. And he had come into the legislature in 1982, right when the first school funding suit hit, and played a role in that, and then played a role in it in a later school funding suit as Attorney General, and then as governor, and the same with the desegregation suit. So there is an advantage having someone who was intimately involved in two crucial issues, and who was very smart. He's a very smart guy, and he was able to, off the top of his head, give me two long interviews worth of information that I could not find fault with. Now, there's some issues of interpretation here and there, but in terms of
that with almost any subject,
yes,
right?
But in terms of the facts, he was dead on. It was beautifully done. Now, you can't do that you can't go back and interview one of the fellows that had a duel in 1827 or something and find out exactly what were you mad about. You can't do that.
Do you ever allow yourself to think, okay, when Arkansas Narrative History 5th edition comes out in 2113, what is still in and what might not be?
Oh, golly. What an interesting idea. I hadn't thought about that. I had thought about the next edition, in which case I think I'm not going to be a part of it anymore. I hope to be retired by then. But I thought that far, but I haven't thought 100 years ahead. That's an interesting idea.
I ask that because when you were talking about the Lakeview and the school desegregation case and how that has been a very big part of Arkansas for the last 20 years, legislatively and educationally. And you wonder, will that 80, 90 years from now, will it be a paragraph in the book? I mean, there's no way to know, of course.
There isn't. I mean, the interesting part of that question is, will we still be facing some of the same kinds of questions in some new form? There's, in some ways, for example, I didn't go into the voter ID laws, and that was sort of on the horizon at the time we put this book into press. But one interpretation of the current attempts to essentially restrict voting, it's comparable to disfranchisement of African Americans and poor whites in the late 19th century. There's nothing essentially different about that. It's all about limiting the franchise, however you want to construe it. It's very similar to the limitations on new immigrants to the cities, and mostly northern cities, obviously, because we didn't get that many immigrants into southern cities, although there were attempts there in southern cities. Disfranchisement in the late 19th century was aimed at cities, at southern cities, mostly. And segregation, particularly. So, anyway, I think these some of these issues don't really go away. They just become, they just transmute into something mm-hmm. else. And but if you look very closely at them, you can see the antecedents. And I think that's an important thing for us to understand as human beings, how we keep doing the same things.
Yes.
We're not shooting each other on the floor of the state legislature anymore, thank goodness. But we are still doing a lot of the same things.
I think the archaeological chapters of the 2113 book are going to be quite remarkably
Ooh.
Different because every generation of archaeologists has an arsenal, a toolkit of approaches and technologies that the previous generation did not have access to. And so if you were writing archaeology in the 1950s, let's say up to that point, you had to guess how old things were because radiocarbon dating hadn't been invented. Mm. So now we take it as a commonplace that we can measure time quite precisely. More recently, we've developed techniques that enable us to make fairly precise statements about how certain kinds of things were used because they have microscopic wear traces on them that, again, we weren't able to detect maybe until the 1970s, but then from that point on, we've been able to work with that. We have technologies now that allow us to peer beneath the ground and see things on a wider scale.
Without disturbing the ground at all.
Without disturbing the ground, then small-scale excavations permit. So I think it's going to be a different story for the archaeologists. Mm-hmm. They'll have a lot more to say, and I think they'll be able to tell the story in a lot better way than we're able to now.
Well, thank you both very much for your time.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jeannie Wayne and George Sabo are two of the four authors of Arkansas, A Narrative History, 2nd edition, published by the University of Arkansas Press. They talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this month. The other authors are Thomas DeBlack and Morris Arnold.